All right, y'all thought that I might be fibbing. This is proof right now. The Letterman Podcast, we have one sponsor only, but it is Rupert G and the Hello Deli. Thank you very much for sponsoring our show, Rupert.
It's my honor, Mike.
La 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 la.
Welcome once again to the Letterman Podcast. As always, my name is Mike Chisholm. I'm excited to be here and do this. I swear to God, I keep telling y'all I'm excited because the conversations that I have with these people is a dream come true. And I mean, who wouldn't be excited by a dream come true? And the dreams are taking different dimensions. The squares are becoming cubes. It's very cool because now we're getting to a point where some of our guests who came on a first time, we've developed relationships and even seen each other in person and whatnot, and in some cases our wives have gotten together, and now they're coming back on the show as friends with a completely different mindset. The origin story, as we call it in comic book fandom, has been told, and now it's just let's shoot the bull a little bit and talk about David Letterman, comedy, all the things that surrounded the careers of some of these people, where they went, what they did, what they learned. I love that. Today is one of those episodes. Steve Weiner was there. He's an OG, late night writer. He was there on day one. By the way, he's been on the show before that episode. Lots of people really, really liked it. And there were questions that came out of that episode. Those questions have been answered. Steve and I go into that. You can watch the episode to understand that, including why the thumbnail on his previous episode was Dick Van Dyke and where that picture was taken, even though we didn't talk about Dick Van Dyke, which was our little kind of joke, but we talk about it here in this episode, among many other things, including night one of late night one, Bill Murray, and the legend of Bill Murray getting the entire writing staff drunk in preparation to see what they were going to do. Steve tells that story, recollects it. We've got a really cool story. One of the rarest Letterman crew jackets was discussed in this episode. You'll have a lot of fun hearing that story if you like arcane information that really doesn't have any value whatsoever, but you just enjoy hearing things about what went on behind the scenes at late night back in the day. We talk about bigger things as well. I love Steve Weiner. He is fantastic. The wall of books behind him, by the way, in both the first episode and this episode, same wall of books. However, not telling too many tales out of school, he had options. There are other walls of books. He might be one of the most well-read people I've ever met. He's a plethora of wisdom and information. I appreciate him so much. And he's a friend. He and Lori are friends of Candy and I, and it's as a result of the Letterman Podcast, which is mind blowing to me. I'm grateful beyond measure to be able to do this. I hope you're having fun. It's a lot of fun listening to and watching the results. This is our first official episode that we put up in the new studio, or the evolving studio. We got stuff more to come. We say more to come a lot on this thing. I wonder where we got that from. Anyway, I am very appreciative to, Steve, it's good that I'm shooting this intro without Steve being here. I actually shot another intro and then I'm doing it again after the conversation because I just, he is such a great guy and I just appreciate him so much. We talk about Meryl Marco in this episode. Anytime we contribute Meryl Marco with anybody, not contribute, anytime we can tribute Meryl on this show, that's a good day's work as far as I'm concerned. And just the insights that Steve has, he's clearly a master of his craft and has used his craft in a variety of ways. We're going to talk about it right now. This episode is, as always, brought to you in part by the Hello Deli. Go to hello-deli.com. If you want any Late Show with David Letterman merchandise or Rupert G merchandise, if you're in the New York area, please go to the Hello Deli. Get a soup, get a sandwich, get your picture taken with Rupert and May. Just enjoy the experience while we have it. Thank you for being on this journey. Please like, please share, please subscribe. Let's get us to that next level. So I'll tell you this, The moment we get to that next level, whatever that level is, I'll never ask again. I'll be advertising things like contests and all that kind of crap. So thank you very much for supporting the show the way that you have. I'm going to do my very, very best to keep the episodes fresh and fun, insightful, and maybe even, dare I say it, entertaining. So here we go. Now, please, the Letterman Podcast presents episode number, what is this, number 38, maybe? Something like that. We got a couple in the can too. So episode 38, I believe, is what this is, or maybe 39. Who's counting? Steve Weiner returns to the Letterman Podcast. Enjoy.
Embarrass me.
Okay, well, I'm gonna, just so you know, in the intro I edify the hell out of you, so yeah. Okay. No, you like the set?
Yeah, this is new, huh?
Yeah, it's coming along. We're so this bridge is from Late Show. It's actually from Late Show.
Is it really? How did you get it?
So on May 21st, 2020, many of the staff and enthusiasts of Dave lovingly referred to that day as D-Day, Dumpster Day, when the CBS crew showed up and mercilessly just started tearing apart this legendary set and throwing it in dumpsters. And some of the crew went and rescued some of these things, and some friends of mine and I are currently trying to figure out where some of the big bridges and things like that are. Mm-hmm. This one here was rescued that day, and it's one that can fit in a, you know, the studio was so big in the Ed Sullivan Theater that the bridges were huge. This one here could actually fit in a normal home studio. So very happy to have that.
That's very nice. I have one request for you.
Yes, sir.
One request. Can you please, for the love of God, take the picture of Sarah Palin off the back wall while I'm talking to you? I don't ask much. I think that if I have to look at that woman for this next hour, this is going to be a very, very different conversation than it would normally be.
I think it's
only fair. I mean, really, if I had a picture of Hitler over my shoulder, wouldn't it change the tenor of things? Please. No, just put it down. Put it away. Put it down. Put it away. If you won't actually torch it in my presence, at the least you can do is keep it the hell off the set. Thank you.
Can you believe I got her to endorse the Letterman Podcast?
Oh, I can actually believe it. I can believe it. That's one of the easier things that anyone's ever asked me to believe. Yes, I believe it. She couldn't even win her election in Alaska. So, yeah, she's down to promoting podcasts now.
Yeah, but she tried to get Dave fired. I mean.
Well. Is that that's a reason to keep her on the wall there like that? I mean,
well,
really.
That's why I thought when the opportunity arose in front of me, I thought it was the universe giving me an opportunity for comedy. That's for darn sure.
Well, there's comedy, I guess, and there's comedy. There's different kinds of comedy.
Well, you know, I think back, you know, it's so funny. I remember when, and I'm not a political guy. I don't want to get into, you know, I don't want to divide people and all that kind of stuff. But it's funny about the things that we used to make fun of with politicians. Like famously, Johnny Carson never got a chance to make fun of Bill Clinton. You know, he left right as that began. Dave never got a chance to be doing what he did when Donald Trump was president. You know, it was, but Dave did have George W. Bush. And I mean, they had those legendary segment, great moments in presidential speeches. And it was just George just being George. And that's all they did was put a couple little clever edits around it and just let him be him. Boy, is it a different time now when it comes to... You know, instead of George Bush, you know, tripping or falling into a door or trying to open a door and it not opening, you know, and this is the recipe for comedy, poking fun at our leaders. It's a different animal now, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, I think there should have been a little more of that kind of comedy even when George Bush was president. But, you know, everybody to their own taste. And, you want to keep the audience large, I guess. I mean, Colbert's done very well, with the people who feel the way he does. And that's been a nice enough, large enough audience to keep him rolling. So,
and I not can't just rolling number one, which is crazy. Yeah.
I don't know. Is that crazy considering the competition? I don't know. It just seems logical to me. I mean, I haven't really seen Kimmel at all, so I don't want to say anything about him. I can do without Jimmy Fallon generally.
Well, it's a bit of a game show thing. Hey, you know, actually, I want to talk about Fallon a little bit here. I have this sometimes. in the wrestling business, people talk about fantasy booking. I would put this person, or the boxing business, or whatever. I would love dream matchups. I do that with this is just gives you a little bit of insight as to the freak that I am. I do talk show fantasy booking. I always think about ideas that I would love to see in these shows. There's a Fallon idea that I have. We recently just had Joe Grossman on. Phenomenal guy. I love him so much. He was a writer for Late Show for a long time. Now he's writing for Fallon. And it was funny after we conversed, I sent him an email, going, hey, wait a second. Do I have a pitch line for the Tonight Show right now? Could I actually every once in a while send you ideas, to pitch? Because I've always had this piece of fantasy booking, and it has to do with actually something that I believe started while you were at Late Night. Were you there when Elevator Races started?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't know they did them more often, I guess. I do remember Elevator Races, yeah.
You remember the genesis, probably, is what you remember.
Well, I remember, I guess, the first one. I didn't know there was actually more than one.
My idea is this, and this is something I want to talk to you about, Steve, for sure as well. This is going to segue into how you really, at the end of the day, didn't watch a ton of Dave, especially during the late night years after you left. And I like that because you've got a fresh perspective in many, many ways. But my idea, anyway, here's my fantasy talk show booking. It's that later on in the Late Show, or early in the Late Show run, Dave would periodically call up Johnny Carson for various reasons. This is after Johnny retired. And one of the things that he called Johnny for was he asked him if they could use Stump the Band moving forward in Late Show as that moved forward. And it was a neat conversation. It was the young lion talking to the old legend, and it was a neat thing. And then we got to see that move on. My idea was the idea that Jimmy Fallon would call up David Letterman and say, hey, can we use Elevator Races? And then have him and Seth do some sort of comedy piece that would go from one show to the other. And it would capture a little bit of that magic that you guys had at 30 Rock. That was one of the things that I think was so special about your shows at 30 Rock, was that you would involve the rest of the broadcast building and the family that was in there. I thought that was a very inventive thing. Was that something? So anyways, that's my little piece of fantasy talk show booking, but was that something that was there from the get-go that you guys were going to kind of cause trouble to the studios around you and all that?
I don't think anybody made a conscious choice. I think it's something that just evolved. I can't even remember whose idea Elevator Risk was, probably Merrill's, but I'm not, I genuinely don't know. So if anybody does know, and it was somebody else, I apologize. No, I don't think it was specifically that. I think it was just trying to mess with the format. When you start the first episode starts with that behind the scenes tour, right? So we were showing behind what was going on, and that I think was definitely a Merrill idea. I think we all contributed jokes to it, but I think that was Merrill and Dave's idea. And so I think it was right from the beginning was the idea of messing with the idea of the show. I think they did some of that on the morning show too. So I think it was just. A lot of this comes from Steve Allen, and Steve Allen was all over that kind of thing. Doing people and putting camera out on the street and making fun of people on the street, or doing stuff about in the studio, going out into the with the audience and doing stuff like that. In fact, a number of his bits. It's interesting you said that they asked permission to use Stump the Band. I think it was a Carson invention, but a lot of Carson sketches were actually, I can politely say, lifted from Steve Allen.
Sure.
The soap opera bit where he pans around the audience and does they call it Edge of Wetness on the Carson show. That came from there. The Tea Time movie thing was definitely a Steve Allen bit. There are others too. I know Jonathan. He stole Aunt Blabby was an outright steal from Maud Frickett from Jonathan Winters. So Carson was lifted a lot of material. So it's interesting that other people were a little more polite than he may have been when doing his show.
There's a couple things with that. Now, number one, Johnny is carrying the mantle of the Tonight Show. So you wonder at that point there, is this a franchise, legacy piece that we could just continue on and evolve and change things around? Or is it, and this is, I want to talk to you about the comedy writer mentality, because this is something
I can tell you something specific to that, because I actually asked Steve Allen that very question when he was on the show. So because we wrote a sketch for him that got unfortunately ran too long, got cut in half, so it doesn't make any sense on the air.
Right.
But the original idea was funny, and you know, we got to spend the better part of the afternoon with Steve Allen, and we're both huge Steve Allen fans. So I asked him. I said, "Look, I started listing all these things, and there were a couple of others I didn't mention to you, but there were a bunch that they took from him."
Yeah.
And he said, you know, first thing he was trying to be polite. I said, "Does it tick you off?" And he said, "Well, you know, Johnny's a very different comedian. He's got his own style and he's got his own thing. But yeah, it does tick me off." So that's the answer.
Wow.
He was not happy about that. He said he's absolutely perfectly fine with David Letterman doing bits of his, because he said Dave always credits him. So he said he really liked David. He really admired David. And he said he had no problem when Dave did something that he might have done before, because he always mentioned it.
I'll tell you this. One of my favorite Don Giller compilations, and it's literally comfort food for me. Like if I'm homesick on the couch or something and I want to put some comfort food on, I put on his compilation of Dave interviewing talk show hosts over the years, because it's like seven parts and each part's like an hour and a bit. Like it's expansive. Mm-hmm. And I would say a complete archive. But I love the beginning for a couple of reasons. Whenever he had guys like Alan or Parr or some of these other folks, Merv for that matter, some of these people on, and Dave was such a freshman interviewer, you know, and I mean, we've talked at length about on this show about Dave's evolution as an interviewer from literally freshman all the way up to, you know, PhD. We watched it in front of us over the three decades, but the reverence this kid would, like, you would literally see Dave getting nervous in front of these people. You talk about the respect, the reverence he had for these people who came before him. Of course, Johnny Carson being, you know, the top of the heap, but every single other one, you know, that was evident. Even though you guys were changing the format, the respect you guys all seem to have, you guys and gals all seem to have, for the ones who came before, seems to be paramount.
Yeah, well, I think you know, again, we weren't sitting there thinking doing something in this style or that style. We're just trying to get the stuff in. But certainly, you know, I mean, I think there was that always that Steve Allen connection in what we were doing too, a sense of that kind of thing. But you know, we moved off into our own direction.
Yeah.
But I think part of the reverence is, I always suspected, was certainly at that time when, as you said, he was just a novice interviewer, is how you know, with Jack Parr he always looked nervous. That was part of his bit, but he was still very comfortable having the conversation, probably more than Dave was at that time. So I think he aspired to that probably too. And I think he eventually got there. So certainly that, you know, and he also, I think, and you know, I'm just playing the mind reader, which any you probably are good as I am in this case, but I think Dave had a real reverence for people that are just broadcasters, what we used to call classic broadcasters. So it didn't even have to be the people who did what he did.
Yeah.
You know, he also liked Tom Snyder very much. You know, he liked Keith Olbermann. He liked people who had that kind of comfort with the camera, who can really do that kind of thing. And I think those are the people he really respected, those, you know, and certain comedians, but I think actors not as much on some level. I always got that feeling he didn't have that kind of connection to actors when he was interviewing them. He could do it and enjoy it, but I don't know. I wondered if you asked him, do you have a favorite actor? I'm not sure he would have. I wonder what his answer would have been, or if he would have had one. I don't know if anybody ever did that. But when you start talking about people in television, he had a long list.
Without a doubt. I love that we kind of moved over here, because there was leftovers from the previous time that you were on this show. And this is the first time that we've done this since, you know, since becoming friendly, since Candy and I came over and had a beautiful, beautiful brunch. You know, it's great. I'm feeling this kinship with you, and it's a lovely, lovely thing. But then there's always that, okay, but what happens when the wives get together? And you and I lucked out in the sense that our wives connected beautifully, and it's like, all right, right on. Steve and I can be friends now. We actually can have that that level.
I don't think of that many of the wives of my friends who were like miserable about the prospect. I mean,
Well, I mean, how could anybody, Candy, by the way, not be friends with your wife? Lori is unbelievable. What an amazing woman. Well,
she's listening at the door. So if she doesn't faint altogether.
I would expect nothing less and hope for nothing less. The regard we have for both of you is so high. One of the things that I wanted to talk about the last time, we talked about it at breakfast a little bit, and you told me some beautiful stories. This is the generational part of this that you and I are just talking about, these Reverend Steve Allen, these giants who were broadcasters, but comedic broadcasters right from the get-go. And I think that many times when I say what I'm about to say, people kind of look at me funny, but at the end of the day, there were broadcasters who had a comedic slant right from the invention of television. It's not a new thing, but Gen X is a little bit different. I love talking about this generational stuff with you, and I've got some questions today about that. But this is the statement I've used before, and you have a little bit of a specific insight to this. David Letterman is my Walter Cronkite. And so he just is the guy that I kind of looked to and trusted. Walter Cronkite was one of those trusted newsmen, but for Gen X, we had this is where I think that the apathy kind of started, the kids of the baby boomers who did so much to change so many things. And the next generation is just going to be apathetic about the previous one. That's just, we're seeing it now with millennials, how they view us.
Sure.
But now Walter Cronkite, David Letterman is my Walter Cronkite. Uh-huh. You lived across the street from the guy.
We did for many years.
For decades, you know? Yeah.
Well, that's many years. I mean, I actually met him a couple of times because my father knew him through, my father was, he was a playwright and writer, but he also was for many years a deputy executive director of the Writers Guild, which he'd helped to found. And he used to ask, Walter to do the annual awards dinners. So he knew him a little bit. And he was Cronkite was just a really, really nice man. I mean, he was exactly who you would sort of hope he would be. I can't say I knew him or anything, but I met him a number of times, and he couldn't have been nicer each time that I met him. So it was nice to have, somebody who really was like that. He seemed to be the guy you saw on television.
Oh, I love that. That's such a beautiful thing to say that about somebody who has that, the what you see is what you get idea. And that's what you would hope. When I hear some of these stories about somebody who has a super high following or is in a really top position, and then you hear about their behavior behind the scenes, and boy, is that ever a focal point of our culture these days? A reckoning is happening with people who behave badly and what can happen. But there's a little bit of disappointment that comes in. It's kind of like hearing that your favorite baseball player is a dick,
but aren't they all?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
oh, I don't know. I don't
not
know.
In my experience.
Okay. I don't know. And whenever I hear a story about a baseball player, it's usually something unpleasant. So I'm just hoping that there's some nice ones out there too.
Oh, heavens. The industry of sport has many inspirational, uplifting lessons as well. Good. But it's the ones that aren't that I think, people remember and they focus on. Walter's one of those guys where, you hope what you see is what you get with him.
That actually reminds me of one of my favorite lines in a movie that hardly anybody saw. And I'm not a sports person. I don't know, but I don't follow this stuff. But Ron Shelton, who most people know from the famous Kevin Costner, the baseball picture.
The Natural.
Thank you. No. That's
Field of Dreams. Sorry, Field of Dreams.
No, not that either. He did a lot of
Bull Durham.
Pictures. Yes, thank you. Ron Shelton wrote and directed that.
I was going to get it. The Kevin Costner baseball movies. I think I know, there's I nailed so many all three of them.
There was another one that Sam Raimi directed that called For the Love of the Game. He did a lot of baseball.
Oh, For the Love of the Game. Oh, my God.
Right.
Yeah.
In any case, Ron Shelton did a picture called Cobb, about Ty Cobb, who was one of the most unpleasant people in the business, ever. And there's a great line in that I remember many times in my business where somebody I'm not going to remember anybody's name today, but the actor who played the journalist who was also a comedian. If you're a bad member, somebody will remember this. In any case, he's talking to Lolita Davidovich and at a bar after, following Cobb around all the time. And she says, why do you put up with it? And he says, I think he's a genius. And she says, genius is overrated. And I've always remembered that line. In some cases, people get a pass because they're really, really great at something. And I think that has been a tradition, not just in sports, in show business, in a lot of things.
Sure.
And I think maybe there's a reckoning across the board for some of the people who might be good at something, but are also, you know, assholes basically. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it doesn't take away from what they did, but maybe that should not be an excuse.
This is the conversation I wanted to get into, and it's beautifully evolving right over that way. I think you're right. I think that we're seeing that, and that theory tested. We're seeing people who are actually right now at the time of this recording, we're seeing people who have this larger than life place, or at least they self-perceived larger than life place, and they're testing what they can say. I mean, at the time of this recording, the Kanye stuff has just happened. Well, right. The Kanye, how specific, isn't it funny how I could say that. And if this was 10 years ago, people would say, oh yeah, that Kanye stuff. And now that Kanye
there's stuff. Always some new stuff, but
there's always some new stuff. This current Kanye stuff, current Elon Musk stuff. Right. You've got these larger than life characters that are testing the boundaries of what can be said and cannot be said, and are they stretching things, and are they evolving free speech versus, you know, shouting fire in a crowded theater? You know, I just it's a fascinating time.
Yeah, it's the art versus the artist conundrum, and yes. I think that, you know, there are people who everybody's got a different line of what they can tolerate and then still enjoy that performer. It in my case, for example, a lot of the performer, I mean, someone like Bill Cosby, who, yep. you know, I grew up, you know, a lot of people grew up in the 80s, they grew up in a sitcom, but I grew up on his stand-up, which was, I think he was one of the greatest stand-ups who ever lived.
Oh, Bill Cosby himself is one of the greatest comedy albums I've ever encountered.
And, yeah. But all of his comedy, you know, his albums from the 60s, and, you know, I remember his stand-up, you know, I saw him, at, you know, in several times live do stand-up. He's phenomenal.
Yeah.
I knew, I mean, in the business, people knew he was not liked. I mean, they knew he was a womanizer. They knew he was just not a pleasant person. I used to hear stories backstage about how unpleasant he was as a person.
Yep.
I didn't hear that. No one heard the serial rapist story, to the best of my knowledge.
Right.
And I find it now hard to go back and look. It's bizarre. I mean, it's still interesting because I watched, I don't know if you saw this documentary series, We Need to Talk About Cosby, which was really well done. And
I haven't yet. Where is that?
It's on Hulu, I think, but I believe. It's okay, W. Kamau Bell, I think, then, and it's really, really good, because they really analyze. First of all, they also discussed over the episodes how important he was in each decade for different reasons. Important in the 60s for stand-up, important in the 70s because of the kids' show stuff.
Yep.
In the 80s for the sitcom, all of that. So you have to discuss how important he was before you discuss what was going on at the same time, which is what he does. And I think that really puts it into the context, but at the same time, I don't think I could really watch him again, but they ran clips from some of his stand-up and I was laughing again. So it's like, it's impossible not to, because he was that good. But there were people that, you know, I mean, I was huge and still am a huge Jerry Lewis fan.
Yeah.
I had a really nice meeting with him backstage at Letterman. He couldn't have been nicer, but I know people personally who had horrible experiences with him. And there was an article about him in Vanity Fair more recently with telling some stories that, you know, I didn't know, but were not that surprising. Mm-hmm. I can't stop laughing at Jerry Lewis at this point in my life, but I would understand people who could not make that jump. Okay. You know, there's a lot of that, and I keep saying to people, because I have a certain amount about history of classic Hollywood and classic broadcasting as well, is that if we start going backwards in time, there's not going to be anybody left for you. So or maybe a handful, you know, Jack Benny, everybody was the nicest man in the world. There were a handful of people who were really, really nice.
Yeah.
But once you start going through the history of show business, not just comedy, but acting and Hollywood and whatever.
And looking at it with today's glass, today's vantage point.
It's going to be hard to look at a lot of these people.
Sure.
So I don't fault people who might still like a given performer that I may not be able to connect to. But I because I grew up with all of these performers, most of whom were probably not very nice people. I think I make that detachment in my head, to at least to varying degrees. But I guess once you get up to serial rapists, it's harder.
Well, okay, so yes, that's just it. Now, I mean, we're talking about an extreme example from an extreme giant, like culture changing. Right. Like you think about somebody for an African American, I mean, to get to the place that he did and what he did for, you know, I remember an episode of The Cosby Show that I watched and as a kid, and this is to my memory, the first time I ever saw the Martin Luther King "I Have a Dream" speech, and it was a very simple scene. It was the very end of an episode. I don't know if it was around the time of when, at that point, the holiday wasn't there, but it might have been Martin Luther King's birthday. I'm not sure why it aired when it aired, but basically, an episode of The Cosby Show happened. It was a typical episode, and at the end, they came out of the kitchen. I think it was Rudy who was sitting in front of the TV, just watching the "I Have a Dream" speech, and I believe that's the first time I ever saw that speech as a child. On the Cosby Show. Yeah. And you look at what Bill Cosby did, like you said, and all I'm doing is accentuating your point, Steve, is right. The idea of talking about the great stuff before we move into that. So these are extreme examples, but the Men's Mental Wellness podcast that I host, you know, I don't think when we were Gen Xers, you know, Nirvana listening, flannel wearing, coffee drinking, apathetic, you know, generation, I don't think that we had in our minds the idea that as we pushed the envelope in the specific ways that we did, the problem that we were going to have when we were in our 40s and 50s is that we were going to take our lives, the memory of our lives at that time, where we were just stumbling along. We were just trying to figure things out. We were trying to just, you know, and then we would be judged on the actions or the behaviors of the culture. I was raised on Porky's. I mean, and in locker rooms that were very different than locker rooms now, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't think any of us could foresee, you know, as we were thinking, oh, it's safe to be gay. You know, that the Gen X, that's the badge of honor that we kind of wear. You know, and it's safe to come out and all of that kind of stuff. And we challenged a lot of things. I don't think we could have predicted that this was going to be one of the problems that we had with the generation that followed. And in comedy writing specifically, you and I talked about this at breakfast. And mm-hmm. I edified the heck out of you. You are a professor. We talked about how Steve's doing, you know, a comedy writers class at NYU. You are a fucking professor, Steve. You just are. You could be doing this. And I love the discussion we had about comedy writing in today's day and age, because I said the same thing that many of the cutting edge comics right now say, who have no problem testing the boundaries. If it's funny, it's okay. And I said that at the table, and we got into a really nice discussion about that, because, you know, the idea of actually having responsibility. Okay, it may be funny, but are you being responsible in saying these things?
You know, I think I'm different from a lot of the people I know my age or who are in this business, because the whole thing that, you know, I see some people that I know, not a lot of them, fortunately, but the thing is, you know, you're this, well, woke people, you can't be funny, and no one can be, nothing's funny anymore. Well, actually, that's bull.
Yeah.
And it really infuriates me when I hear people who actually should know better talk about it, particularly people who are politically otherwise in would be in my camp. And I think that I hear that, and it really annoys me, because what they're really saying is they can't be funny anymore with the material that they did when they were starting out maybe 30 years ago or 40 years ago or 20, or even 20 years ago. And the fact of the matter is, comedy always changes. It always did. I'm sure if I went through if you and I went through the Letterman archives together from 82, there's jokes we wouldn't do anymore.
Absolutely.
Okay? In the same token, that was 40 years ago. 40 years before the Letterman show was the middle of World War II, and they were doing jokes about Germans and Japanese people that we wouldn't do in 1982.
Yes.
Things change.
Yes.
And I really annoy. And also, when they say nothing's funny, there's so much comedy out there right now that's funny. What are you talking about? And that none of these people the young people who are doing comedy now seem to have terrible trouble getting. I mean, some do because they particularly push the boundaries. That's their choice.
Sure.
That's a choice. But there are plenty of people who can write really good and create or perform really good comedy that isn't necessarily racist or sexist or homophobic or whatever. There's a lot of topics that the world to write comedy about or perform comedy about. You don't have to do the same jokes you did before. And, you know, I've always said, you know, if your old joke doesn't work, write a new one. That is literally the definition of the job. Okay. I mean, I don't get it. You know, and I know that there are people who say, well, that you're doing, you know, you can say this because you're not working the business anymore. Well, that, okay, if you want to say that, fine. But if I were working the business, I would hope I would be writing, you know, anybody who writes for any particular project fits their what they do to that project. You don't write the same for David Letterman as you do writing for the Disney Channel. You don't write, you know, and you, it's a different, just because it's a different show, it's a different job.
Yep.
So you learn to adapt to what you're doing. And ideally, there's a point where what they're doing, what you do, that something that's you meshes, so that I can look at something on a show that I worked on and say, yeah, that represents something that's of me, but it fits into this context. Meryl said something to me once that I always remembered because it was a really nice thing. But I think she was right. And I think it was her doing. She said, what she loved about the show is about the writers in the show is there's so many different styles of comedy writing on the show, but they all fit together.
Yep.
They all work together, you know, and I think that was something that I don't know if she was particularly, and David were particularly looking for that, but that's certainly when I was there, that's what we got. That's what we had. Our style was different from you know, Tom and Max's style. It was different from Andy's style, you know, whatever. It was different, but it was still right for Dave.
Meryl fascinates me, Steve. She just because she is in my, you know, and not just my God. I mean, who am I? She is the mother of late night, you know. And when you think about that, and not just the show late night. I'm talking the genre. I'm talking, you know, she brought the sensibility of a mother in so many respects. You can say that on
yeah, I don't, many I don't more see levels. That but I don't see that, but I'll take your, I mean, in the sense that I mean, I think Meryl is a genius, but the last thing I would accuse her of being is maternal, and I don't think the show reflects that. I think what it does reflect is a really specific and really original style of comedy that she has, that was hers, and that meshed so well with Dave's at the beginning, but Meryl continues to write great material on her own that has nothing to do with David, because that style was her. And I think that they meshed perfectly. And that the show to me was always this great combination of David and Meryl. And then ultimately us after, you know, down the line, but those two are the keystones of what made the show what it was.
The alchemy of the two.
The alchemy, their alchemy together was specifically what the show was. And the rest of us, you know, fit in where we could.
So I was going to go down the path of the fact that, you know, the mother, the protective role, how she protected the rest of the staff from the network.
Well, she did do that. Like that. She did do that. Yes, that's true. I would absolutely give her credit for that.
But her fingerprints, and maybe it is. Maybe it is just that alchemy. I think about dog poetry and some of these things that just, to me, a man doesn't come up with some of the stuff and from the angle that she did. Mm-hmm. But then take when you look at her background.
Yeah,
she wasn't raised and bred to be this maverick leader. She was an art. She was an artist. Yep. You know, her background was an artist. So part of it wasn't just the genius and the intelligence that she brought to the table, but it was also the fresh perspective coming from out of nowhere,
right.
And looking at this. You know, she'd never run a show before, and then you know, on the morning show, famously, it's like, okay, well, it's here. Just you go, take the reins.
Right.
You know, no one's driving the stagecoach. Here you go.
Right.
You know, and that part of it as well, bring that fresh perspective in is a huge part of it as well. I have nothing, but I love when the old school guys come on here and sing Meryl's praises. We haven't had her on the show yet. I want to very, very, very badly. Obviously, the level of respect I have for her is through the roof. And what I love, and that's me as a viewer, me as a guy who really appreciates this. But what I even appreciate more, and this kind of goes back to the Cronkite thing, is how much the warhorses like you, you know, and everyone else who worked for her, the level of respect that they have for her is it's gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good. No, that
it would not have been the same show. I mean, it would not even close. Which is not at all taking anything away from David at all.
No,
but I mean, you know, it was a case of taking David's sensibility and finding a way to make that work as a television show.
Yes,
and you know, that was where they combined so well that they both knew what they wanted to do, and they each had their own individual way of achieving it. and that it just worked. You know, I mean, nobody really wrote better for Dave than Merrill did. And by the same token, things that, you know, that I see Dave's things that make me think of Merrill back going the other way direction. That, I mean, they just, the fact, it was just that connection, you know, it was able to, you know, I'm not taking away the other people who worked on the show. You know, Merrill was only there as head writer for a short time, really, by the comparison with everything else. Yeah. And the show changed from the other people who worked there. It changed when Steve O'Donnell was there,
yep,
as head writer. It changed, you know, all along the way.
Yep.
But without that first grounding, you know, who knows?
I would definitely agree with that. It's very cool that you have that perspective. It's just very few of us do, because Dave is kind of the, you know, what we see with Dave is he's the Frankenstein of all of these other writers. You know, I've talked to so many writers.
There's a danger there too. And I want to stop you because,
please.
And I find myself doing this sometimes too, when I'm raving about Merrill, which is in a sense almost to make Dave sound like a puppet of some sort, or like, you know, and that is absolutely not the case.
Yes.
I mean, every word that came out of Dave's mouth was something Dave either wanted, with something supplied that he liked, or his own.
Yes.
And by the way, one of the connections between David and Steve Allen is that they were the two greatest improvisers I ever saw in my life.
Yep.
And I never saw anybody. And there was a frustration sometimes on the show, a minor frustration, but we could never write jokes as funny as Dave could come up with ad-libbing in the moment.
On the fly. Yes.
On the fly. Yep. And we just sit back and say, you know, wow. And that was continuous. That was always there. So he didn't, you know, it felt, it's fun to write for him because he wrote great, you know, it was because of that. But then you would sit, the things I loved best watching the show were just the things where Dave was winging it, when he was just out, you know, when he was talking to members of the audience or talking to this, or, you know, whatever happened. And that's another thing Dave loved, when things went wrong in the show, because then it would give him more leeway to ad-lib.
Without a doubt. I mean,
he was so brilliant at that. Still is, you know, I mean, he's just that fast. He had that kind of brain that could work that way. So I think the composite is Merrill as a writer and Dave as a writer thinker at the same, yes, you know, sometimes people would say, you know, because Dave always had a writing credit on the show. I said, well, was that justified? Well, yeah, because even if he did, and he did write occasional bits for the show, but he didn't do it that often. But if 40 to 50% of the laughs on a given show came out of Dave's mouth ad-libbing, that's writing. Ad-libbing is writing.
Absolutely. Oh, of course it is. You know, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you were, if you had, I know you would come and kind of come in and out, and you're aware of a lot of these things that happened after the fact, but I think about when Rod Blagojevich came on and, you know, he comes on and sits down, and this is before, you know, this is just as things are, he's right in the headlines, you know, and he comes and sits down and he looks at Dave and goes, oh boy, I've wanted to be on this show in the worst way. And Dave, without even missing a beat, well, you're sure as hell here in the worst way. He said it like so fast, and it was that's, yes, absolutely, that writing on the fly, like that's Dave's, that's his calling card, is these ad libs. And I think I don't know if it was your
one of the most fun,
go ahead.
I said one of the most fun moments for me on the show, because it didn't happen often, but once Merrill came and asked everybody, because they were doing a thing with Ron Popeil, you probably don't remember who he was. He was a guy who did this crap that they would sell in the middle of the night, you know, really cheesy products that they would sell, commercials. And he invented
an earlier incarnation of the ShamWow guy.
Yeah. But he did a whole bunch of products, and there were like dozens of them. And so he was on the show and he was going to present some of those, show some of those things. And Merrill said, if you have any ideas for ad libs for this, you know, can you toss them in? And he picked one from me and one from Carl's. He didn't get to use Carl's. He actually apologized to Carl later for not getting to it, because it was a great line. The one that I wrote, he had a thing called Mr. Dentist that he was selling, which was a box of tools, you know, that you could perform dentistry on yourself. And the line I gave today was, I understand you had a bit of legal trouble with your Mr. Brain Surgeon. And Dave said it as if, and it sounded like he was making it up. He actually was reaching for another one of these products when he said it. So it sounded like, as I wrote a Dave ad lib. That's, you know, that's about as good as can get.
That's the only time. Fantastic.
The only time that ever happened that I can recall.
Hey, yeah, that's a good one. And the fact that you get one, you know, that's.
Yeah, I got one.
Yeah.
And it sounded like him, which is the ideal. I mean, it sounded like he made it up, which is what you really want it to be. in that context. You know, whenever you're writing for any given comedian, you really want it to sound like his voice. And that's the first thing you learn is to adjust. And I remember our first couple of days working with Robert Klein, and, you know, I knew Robert Klein. I saw his first Carson appearance. I was a fan of his for a decade before I worked for him, more than a decade. And yet we were doing remote pieces. The first thing we did with Robert was remote pieces for NBC Bloopers and Practical Jokes show. It was Robert on the streets in New York. And without even being aware of it, we started writing lines that were a little Dave-ish. And Robert said, and he sort of caught us immediately. He said, you know, that's a Dave line. And it never happened again. You know, then we started adjusting our material. Then
I'm going to put you on the spot. You don't remember the context, or you don't remember the joke, do you? No, okay,
not at all.
That's fantastic.
I think it was probably an insult. I think it was like an insult, and you know, Robert doesn't do those. He doesn't do insults.
Yeah,
and you know, I should have been the first one to realize that. Maybe I haven't been a fan of his for that long. But it did, you know, to our credit, we shifted fast, and then we never had that note from Robert again.
And I don't want to tell tales out of school with this or anything like that, but does Robert have a regard for Dave? Is there a thing there?
I would imagine
the mutual respect is formidable.
I know Dave did for Robert.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think that Robert did. I think, you know, Robert's context, he doesn't really talk about comedians of his own time very much person. He loved the same people that I love, which is the older comedians. You know, he adores Phil Silver. The Bilko Show is one of his favorites. He loves the Marx Brothers and Buster Keaton and Laurel and Hardy. And you go to his house, he's got posters of these, you know, original posters, Marx Brothers posters of that stuff. And so we connected very quickly on that score. And, you know, I think it was the first birthday that I was working with him. We got him a copy of the new, at that time it was a new book on Stan Laurel. It's still on his shelf when I visit his house. I can still find it on the shelf. So we connected very quickly that way. And then that he adores those people. And you see a lot of that too. Like every now and then you hear Robert do a W.C. Fields take reaction, or you'll do a bit of Phil Silver's. He used to call when we were working for him. He would go, "Why not Tiedemann? Hey, you know, he's doing this with Bill." So I started calling him Sarge when we were working for him, just to keep it going. So that was that. But I think he respected Dave. He respects Dave very much.
Yeah. I love this legacy of influencers versus influencees. Mm-hmm. And I mean, influencer has taken a completely different turn when you look at that term now, but, you know, Robert Klein to Jerry Seinfeld.
And it makes me crazy now that they're, and I hate that it's happening, but there's too many people I'm running into who don't know who he is.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you know who Seinfeld is and you don't know who Robert Klein is, Jerry Seinfeld would be the first person to say you ought to know who Robert Klein is, because he cites Robert as one of his, if not his definitive influence. Robert was one of the first great comedians to stand-ups to do what we call observational humor. It wasn't one-line gags with my mother-in-law is so whatever. It was material about life, about daily life, about things that you saw, things that you did. And he was still is, you know, if you see him perform now, he's still the best at that. And he's just such a great mark for the, I mean, I remember hearing, I think I told you a story, but I think it was off camera, that I saw a show that when Jay Leno had Billy Crystal on Jay's show, and they were both talking about, you know, how much influence Robert Klein was. And Chris, and I think it was Jay said, yeah, in my room, in my, you know, when I was getting started, I had a giant poster of the Child of the 50s record cover was on my wall. That was the guy I had on my wall. Yeah. And, you know, you just see Robert was so big. And I really wish people would reinvestigate. I mean, you can get a box set of his HBO special. He was the first comedian to do an HBO special, the very first.
Yep.
And there is a box set of DVDs of his HBO specials, all of them. And I highly recommend them to anybody who cares about comedy at all. There's not a ton of Robert stuff on YouTube because I think Robert's protected it very carefully.
Yeah.
But go buy it. I mean, the records are available on CD, or you could, you know, be able to download them. They're probably on Spotify or listen to the records, buy them, see the DVDs. And they're just as funny now as they ever were, because, you know, he's talking about the daily things, you know, daily things of life. I quoted him the other day because, I mean, I was, I, I had a very entertaining weekend. I tripped going to the theater coming out of a train station, and
I'm
going to
ask to see the finger. Absolutely.
I dislocated. Yes, it's this finger, which, as you know, is very. I told the doctor, I said, you know, this is very important in New York City discourse. You can't live without this finger. You have to fix this.
You almost spit dignity there, Steve.
Thank you. It's good for Danny Thomas. Another one no one knows. It's good for us too. But I was in there and they were trying to decide what painkillers. And they said, what's your pain level? And I said, well, you know, it's like up here. So I guess we were going to do. He listened to a couple. He said, but how? I think morphine's good. And I said, you know, I went like that. I said, Robert Klein's line, which is, and I always identify it. He has a bit about being bitten by a squirrel and having to go to the hospital.
Okay.
And in the bit, he talks about getting morphine for the pain. And he says, the thing about morphine is you still feel the pain. You just don't give a damn. So I quoted that to these people and you know, they laughed and, you know, still funny.
You said it in his voice and I could hear it in his voice, which is.
I sort of did. I modified his voice a little bit because since I didn't think they knew who he was, I didn't think doing an impression of him was going to help. But I helped a lot. But I did credit him as a great comedian that I know. So I used his name.
Just shout out to our first episode with Steve. Go back and watch it because he talks about another story where he actually did Robert in front of him in his voice. And anyway, that's in our first episode with Steve. So you can go back and listen to that. Speaking of which, I have a couple little cleanup items that I have to do from people who ask questions from the first episode. The first one's a very simple one. And then the second one is like, the second one's probably simple, but we could go deep with it if we wanted to, because he's in the news. But the first one's very simple. The thumbnail picture. Oh, by the way, I want to show you before we finish here. I want to show you the picture. I got to ask permission to use for the thumbnail for this episode. I'm going to show it into the camera here and make sure that you're okay with it. But the first episode, the picture of you was you and Dick Van Dyke, and we didn't talk about him at all in the episode. And more than like a handful of people. He said, "Hey, you got this picture of Steve and Dick, and you didn't even talk about him. So let's talk about that."
More than a handful is usually my basic fan group. You know, it's like less than a soiree, more than a handful. You know, it's somewhere in there. It was like this was when I was growing up. As I did say last time, I loved all comedians, the older comedians, the contemporary comedians, everybody. Yeah. I just loved everybody, and. I remember my father and I watching our first Dick Van Dyke Show episode together. I remember the episode, the second season episode, about the time, it's a flashback about Rob not being able to get married. Things kept going wrong. And it's a fantastic episode. And it reminded me even as a kid of kind of a Laurel and Hardy kind of episode, very physical. And I fell in love with Van Dyke immediately. You know, and I later found out, of course, he adored and knew Stan Laurel, and knew all these guys, but he loved all that kind of comedy. But from that moment, he was one of my absolute favorite people. And one of the things I always wanted to do in the business was, obviously I was not going to be able to write for the Dick Van Dyke Show because I was too young.
Yes.
I was 10 or whatever.
Yeah.
I said, you know, I would love to write for this guy someday. And, the first spec script I ever wrote when I was still in college was for the new Dick Van Dyke Show. That's the very first card that Carl and I wrote. That was our very first spec script. And you get to a certain age and you realize certain dreams are not going to happen. And you set them aside, right? Yes. You get to your mid 30s and you're not going to work with the Beatles and you're not going to do it as whatever. And so I said, well, it was a nice dream, but I didn't expect it to happen.
Yeah.
And then
you're preaching to the choir with that, by the way.
Of what, playing with the Beatles?
No, just
or just having a dream. Yeah,
never never in a million years did I expect
it's
to be
not
doing
too
this.
Late.
Yeah,
it's not too late for you because you're not much older than I was when this happened to me. I think, and it's all due to my then partner Hillary Rollins I was writing with, and Hillary had worked at Nick at Night, and before she came to the Disney show.
Holy.
And they called her and they said, they had been using Dick Van Dyke as a, they called him Nick at Night's chairman. He did commercials for them. And they wanted to do an evening where he would be introducing his five favorite episodes of the show. And they asked Hillary to write it. And Hillary called me one day and said, listen, I've got this offer from Nick at Night. And I don't know if you, I'd like you to work with me if you want to. It's commercials. I said, well, I don't know commercials. I don't know at this point in our career, is it something we should be doing? He says, they're with Dick Van Dyke. And I said, what time do you want me there?
Yep.
And it turned out more to be more of a show than it was originally supposed to be, just commercial spots, but it essentially became a show.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were gotten this dream job of writing comedy for Dick Van Dyke. And, you know, I have such a vivid memory of all of these things connected with the show. I remember, you know, we were gathering from a group meeting in the offices of Nick at Night with the executives and everybody else. Yeah. And they got Dick Van Dyke on the phone. And you know, they had the speakerphone on, and they said, and
you're a jaded comedy writer by this time. Like you've gone through life.
I was 10 again. And literally, I mean, they said, and these are the writers. This is Steve and Laurie. And Dick's, that voice, which he has, is so distinctive. And he says, hi, Steve. Hi, Laurie. And I literally turned to Hillary and went like this, like that.
Yep.
Like that. It was so stunning to me. But we tried to write, you know, we got a couple of people who had worked on the show before to put on the thing. We were supposed to have Carl Reiner. Unfortunately, his wife took ill around that time, and he had to drop out. But we got Larry Matthews, who played Richie on the show. We got Frank Adamo, who had been his dresser, but he used to work and do spots with him. He was always on that show. If you recognize the tall, lanky guy, you'd know him in a second. And a second dream, this is a two-part dream, because one of the episodes had Kathleen Freeman in it. Now, Kathleen Freeman is one of the great comic actresses of all time. You know her from Jerry Lewis movies. She was the vocal coach in Singing in the Rain, you know, round.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
She was one of the greatest, and she was in one of these. So I said, we've got to get her on the show, too. So we got Kathleen Freeman on the show. That's a whole other story of fandom. But we got all these people. We put this thing together, and, you know, it was a dream come true. We came out to California. The Nick at Night people were wonderful, and they put us up and they brought us out to work on this thing. We were there, and I followed around like a puppy dog for all the time we were doing this thing. He was so nice and so generous with his time, and so easy to, you know, he could have easily. And I said to him at one point, listen, if I get on your nerves, please, I don't want to be that person. Just send me away. He couldn't have been nicer. And you know, I said, there was the picture that you saw, that you used, came from a few years before that on the Mickey Mouse Club, when they opened up the Disney MGM Studios. They were getting footprints, famous footprints, for their grandma's Chinese that they had, and Dick Van Dyke was one of them.
Yep.
So all the writers on the Mouse Club were fans. So we ran out to see if this happen. Then we asked as a group if we could take a picture with them. So we all gather around Dick Van Dyke. And we're standing, and it's taking a while to set up the camera. You know, right. Starting to feel uncomfortable because you don't want to make him stand there for so long.
Yep.
And I actually looked at him, and he happened to turn and look at me at that moment. I couldn't think of anything else to do, so I went like that, and he did like that back to me. And I said, "Well, I've stand with Dick Van Dyke. I can retire from show business."
Yep.
So the first day that I was working, when we first introduced him, I told him that story, and he said, you know, I said, well, you know, the first time I met Stan Laurel, see, I know how he says, it's really sweet for you to say that about how much, you know, and he said, the first day I met Stan Laurel, I came up, you know, and about the time he was very famous, Dick was very famous.
Mm-hmm.
And he was invited to Stan's, he had a little apartment in Venice, California. And he got out of the elevator, and there was a hallway, turning, saw this hallway, and the door opened, and Stan went down, leaned down and says, hi there, Dickie. And Dick said, I could have retired then too. So, you know, it's so.
That's awesome.
I don't know that we connected on that, but he couldn't have been so nice. And the only thing I asked nothing with you for the rest of this thing, except before we leave, I would love to have a two stands picture with you. You know, so I said, if we can do a two stands picture, and we got it. And of course, his stand was much better than mine in the picture. but I think that's only fair. So that's what that picture was about. But it was such a joy.
And we're calling back, by the way, earlier in the episode when we talked about the idea of these people that you look up to, and then when you meet mm-hmm. them, same deal. You've been very blessed that you have a couple of those experiences where it turned out to be better than you even imagined.
Kathleen Freeman was just as great to be with. Wonderful. just a pleasure. She would, during lunch, instead of going off, you know, whatever, she would come and sit with all of us and just tell stories. You know, everybody could ask her questions. We just all tell her stories. She would tell us stories. It was fantastic. And yeah, I've been very, very lucky. Part of it, I think I'm pretty lucky in that I think I have a pretty good sense of who you would want to meet. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah. You oh, wanna... there you go. Yeah.
Because there's sometimes, you know, some people that I have great admiration for, I just have a feeling, let it pass.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. and frankly, Jerry
appreciate
Lewis
the art.
Those...
Don't take it any further than that.
Well, there were a couple of Jerry Lewis fans on the Letterman show. And we were you know, Tom Gamble was a big Jerry Lewis fan.
Yeah.
And we talked about it beforehand and said, you know, because he has a reputation, he can be difficult. I think that may be putting it mildly, but we both figured this is one that we had to make the roll the dice regardless. Yeah. Normally, I think I would have passed, but I couldn't not because it was Jerry Lewis. And, you know,
legend.
You know, legend. One of the first comedians who ever made me laugh hysterically.
Am I going to see Mount Rushmore or not? I mean,
yeah, I mean, you know.
Go see
when
it.
I was like, I mean, I saw the Bellboy came out when I was 1960, so I would have been like 6 or 7. And, you know, and I could laugh forever.
Yeah.
So maybe it was because he was, you know, he was comfortable because he was on a show where he knew everybody liked him. Dave is a big fan. Paul Schaefer is a big fan. He was surrounded by people. He couldn't have been nicer that day. He was just and also I have to say, what I liked about it is he whenever we I would ask him something about, you know, something about him, and he would ask something about the show.
Yeah.
He asked me about Calvert, which came out to be perfect because I was the guy to tell him the story. So he could have been nicer. Other people I know who since then, and I won't tell the stories, but who had really bad experiences with him after that. So I'm not making out Jerry Lewis to be a saint by any means. I'm just saying I got in the case of meeting people you admire, I've been very lucky.
You've had
and
good
experiences. I have no bad experiences with anybody I met that I admire.
You mentioned Calvert DeForest. I'm gonna mm-hmm. say this. Larry Bud Melman.
I met Calvert. He's very nice. You know, I heard he could be evil backstage, but Calvert couldn't have been nicer when he met us. You know,
well,
I mean,
I mean, your perspective is a little different though, because at the end of the day, you're the one
that was
kinda,
a joke. That
oh,
was a joke.
Oh. You know what? You know where I went with that? Because we
I
had
no
Rogalski
idea, but
on.
Apparently, weren't around here. What?
We had Rogalski on not too long ago, and he was one of the guys in charge of like he and Calvert went on the transatlantic adventure, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. He was traveling with him for weeks and weeks and weeks, right? And so
a dream come true for anybody.
Well, oh man, fantastic.
That was also a joke.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
We're losing ground here, aren't we, Mike? Something's happening. I don't know. I've lost the thread, apparently.
No, so. No. No, you certainly didn't. But
if
I mean,
done
you know,
Dave's voice was a dream come true, wasn't it? You know, then would you have gotten it if it was meant to be sarcasm? But go ahead. It was. Remember the Santa Claus thing? It was magic, wasn't it? That was that was Dave's line.
But it was just
it
not
was magic.
The magic that he was.
No,
yeah, which
not
is,
at all.
That's right. By the way, this is the if it's okay with you, I would like to use this as the thumbnail for this episode. If you're okay with this.
Hmm? I can't see it. It's going blurry.
There you go.
No, what is it a picture of? Tell me because I can't. Oh, it's the sponge but I can't tell what the picture is on top of that. Can you tell me? I can't see it.
Absolutely. It's Calvert on stage here. I'll do this here.
Yeah, just it. Oh, okay. Yeah, you can show that. I mean, I wasn't there. I think that was going to the Night of 1,000 Stars or something.
Well, I took that picture in your apartment.
No, but I mean the picture of Calvert. I don't know where the picture of Calvert.
Yeah. I just thought the original sponge,
okay.
your name tag and the original sponge, I thought that would be a good thumbnail for this episode.
Sponge, yes. How much is that worth now? Upwards of $11, I think.
You know, it's funny. There are some folks where if you gathered them all in one room and you put on a spontaneous auction for that sponge, I bet you it would go huge if the right people were in that room. Dave.
No, I was being sarcastic then too. So we'll just keep rolling along here as we are.
Well, Dave put up one of his Worldwide Pants jackets just now. And I believe they suspended the auction because the bid went over $8,000. And they're like, okay, well, hold on a second here. Like there's some people who are crazy for this stuff.
Wait a minute. All right.
He's going to go get it right on.
How much is this weight? Can I get on camera? How much is one of these worth to you, buddy?
Man, that's
original. They stopped making those. These are the ones that didn't have Dave's name on it, because in those days he felt uncomfortable having his name on these things. So this is a first generation Jacket Boy.
Shout out to Mark Carzen, by the way, who basically conceived the idea of the jack for one of the bumpers. That's where the original jacket came from. But yeah, that's one of the OG ones. Oh, you got a fun story about one of those jackets, Carl's version of that jacket.
Oh yeah, I not 100. All right, I'm gonna tell this, but because you asked for it, but Carl didn't, you know, tended to be. And not clear, he had right reason to be. He didn't have a lot of money. I mean, I, you know, even on this, working on the show, whatever, he would tend to be careful with money. And so,
well, especially at that point, you guys are all kids.
At that point,
we didn't
know.
It's an upstart show based on a show that got canceled.
I know my father said when he heard what, because he used to work in television, when he heard what kind of salary we were making, he said, "My God, I can't believe they get that much for that money for doing this."
Perspective.
And now that probably would seem like very little money, I hate to say, after all these years. But in any case, so you never knew. And so they went around and they were asking people to, you know, about the, they were order, we're expecting to pay for our jackets. We all were going to buy our jackets, which was required at Disney later on, because they pay for nothing. But in any case, we and they said, do you want leather or vinyl sleeves? The vinyl sleeves are cheaper. The only person in the entire office who opted for the vinyl sleeves was Carl. And then Dave picked up the tab for all the jackets without telling anybody.
But he got the only vinyl one.
Yeah, because he now he has a limited edition. So you can look at that. It may be more valuable now because he has the vinyl sleeves. Though for all I know, he sold it already by now.
That's exactly the reason I wanted to get this out there. It's the only one. And
it's the only vinyl sleeve jacket. So in the unlikely possibility that Carl's listening to this, take care of that jacket because it's worth money.
I had a couple other questions, little pieces of business to clean up after the last episode. Now, first is, and I'm gonna provide a little bit of insight, and I did in the intro as well. I'm gonna ask you the question here: is this the same wall of books that you're in front of now that you were in front of for our previous interview, or is this a different wall of books?
No, it's the same wall of books.
It's the same one. Okay,
I'm used to this angle.
Okay, but it doesn't have to be the same wall of books.
No, there are other walls.
You have options.
I have options. I have too many books. too much of everything, except work.
Well, I was emailing Lori. Lori and I were going back and forth, and you know, Steve's at the library. It's like, oh, that's perfect. I loved hearing that. That was
a few years ago. We, you know, on the 79th Street Library, I ran to Steve O'Donnell there. So okay, but you know, is that there you are.
I really wanted to be at that breakfast, by the way. When I heard that that he came over for breakfast, I had what the kids call FOMO. I had the fear of missing out. I really wanted to be at that breakfast after we had breakfast, and then O'Donnell came over to your guys' house. I can imagine the conversation would have been fantastic.
Don Giller is very funny. I'm going to quote a Don Giller line now. He was talking about the fact that because in the picture that Steve took with you, his head, he usually tilts his head in pictures, and it was straight up on the picture with you. And he said, that's not Steve O'Donnell because his head's not tilted. And I wrote on Facebook and I wrote back, the spinal surgery was a complete success. So we're all very happy. And what I talked about with Steve, he said, I think I probably do that because I'm tall and I'm just used to trying to get my head into pictures. But I hadn't even noticed that until Don pointed that out, that Steve tilted his head.
Oh, you talk about observational and with a rapier like wit. Giller is just, he's a killer. Giller the killer.
Don's
he's a comedy killer.
Yeah, it's very funny.
Extremely
really
funny.
Now let's stop talking about it because we want to get him a more swellhead than he already is.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't want Don.
Okay, the other thing, and it'll tie this. I hate to end this with you. I thank you so much that we've become friendly, and I'm so grateful we can do this, you know, periodically. And
I really enjoy this. I mean, anytime, you know, I think your audience have had enough by now, but anytime, you know, Lori prepared a whole list of topics we never talked about, and we still have. We didn't talk about Andy Kaufman, I think. Oh, we did talk about that. We didn't talk about Bill Murray, the Bill Murray thing.
There's where we're about to go. I'm about to go to Bill Murray. Yeah. And the reason I want to go to Bill Murray is because I was, you know, for the most part, I'm not criticized too much. And I've got a few people in my life who give me brutal honesty about the show, because the brutal honesty is what helps improve it. But there were a few folks who kindly observed that you were one of the OG Late Night with David Letterman writers. The first episode, legendary in some respects. Those who are in the know understand that Bill Murray being the first guest, insane amount of prep for the first episode as opposed to all the rest of the episodes, because the rest of the episodes, it's breakneck speed. You're literally kind of going as it's rolling, whether you're injured or not, it's rolling. But the first episode, there was a lot of prep, and
writers, there was supposed to be a lot of prep. I don't know how it showed up on the air.
The writers all went to Bill Murray's house,
Bill Murray did that. No one knows where Bill Murray's house is, I don't know. I have no idea. No, he came to 30 Rock because that was stomping ground. But Bill, okay. So this story, there's versions of the story have been told in some of the books and things like that.
Yes,
but I would point out that I probably know more details for it. And I'll tell you, you'll know why in a few moments. Okay.
Yeah.
So this was about a week before. I kept in my stories. I always tell stories incorrectly, and then Don Geller explains to me why I can't possibly be right. Yes. And then he corrects me about my own memories. it was about a week before the show, to try to come up with something to do on this first show for him to do.
Yeah.
And so, he has SNL hours, I guess. So we met after the show, not after the show, but we hadn't done the show yet, but after everybody else left. We go into the conference room and Bill Murray starts prepping the room. And first thing he does, he has one of the old boom boxes, which were, I guess, more typical then.
Sure.
He finds a station he wants, doesn't like the sound quality. So he takes one of the metal garbage cans, turns it over, takes all the garbage out, and puts it inside the can, puts it on the table so the resonance will be to the way he liked it. So he put that there. At some point, he gets one of the surviving interns, whoever's still there, it says, and orders tequila for the room, sends him out for tequila. Now he's got the music going, the tequila's coming in, and he doesn't like the lighting. So he puts the lamp where he wants it. He takes his sweater, and he kind of drapes it around the top of the lamp so the lighting will be correct.
Fire hazard, but it looks good.
Well, what the hell, right? And here comes tequila, so the mark for making margaritas with people. And I'm thinking literally, because this is my first or second week in show business, period. Okay. I literally have come off of not being able to get seen by anybody to working on an NBC television show.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, this is going to be one of those parties that those SNL people have. One of those parties, I thought that was good. I don't know, right? Because we always heard stories.
Yep.
But the thing that people don't say about when they tell that story that I've seen elsewhere is that the moment he had everything to his liking, he sits down and starts trying to write the show. We start trying to write bits. He was absolutely focused on trying to come up with something funny. We didn't get anything funny because the writers were drinking margaritas. What was going to come out of that? So absolutely nothing happened. But I remember it very well because I've never been a drinker and Carl's never been a drinker. So I think we're the only two sober people in the room. So I have a better memory that day than I suspect most of the other guys do. So ultimately, he went off and came up with whatever he would, the thing, the Olivia Newton-John song, Let's Be Physical. He started dancing around. He grabbed one of our stage managers and started twirling her around without letting her know he was going to do that. And that's what he did. And everybody remembers that bit. I think it's more strange than funny, but that's Bill Murray. And it worked. It was, it worked for the show because it was something you wouldn't see everywhere. So that's on the first show you saw that. But that was the story. And I don't have any other, didn't really get to know him. Laurie has something she wants to say. Oh yeah. I mean, the day after the thing, I ran into Meryl first thing in the morning. She and David left long before this was going on. I said, do you know what happened here last night? And she said, yes. And he says, when will Bill learn he can't get good comedy by getting the writer's drunk? She's doing that. That was in a maternal voice. That was being funny, but she was doing it as a fake mother kind of joke.
Yeah.
But yeah, we didn't get anything funny out of it, but it's a story. And other than that, you know, he'd be on the show and I'd say hi. And he did, I think he tended to remember our names. So again, but I don't know much beyond that. I know that, you know, another Bill Murray story I know secondhand, which is that Robert Klein's house is on the top of a hill where there's a golf course at the bottom.
Yeah.
And there's a porch. Robert has a porch, which when you know, that out there, side there. And apparently somebody told Bill Murray what was playing golf. And somebody said to him, do you know Robert Klein lives up the hill? And Bill Murray turns the golf cart around, drives up the hill, drives up the stairs and onto Robert's porch to get him out. I don't know how much Robert, to this day, I don't know how much Robert really enjoyed that experience, but
but that's, because legends love it when enthusiasts show up at their house, even if they're Bill Murray. Like, I mean, you know, that.
Well, yeah, I don't know, but I don't know if they like you driving onto their porch.
I know, right? You know,
that's the question, right? I mean, it's an interesting thing. There's an interesting thing going on now. And again, I don't know him, so I don't know what stories are true or what stories aren't true, whatever. But there's an interesting thing going on where he's starting to get people starting to complain about some of the things he did when he was working on movies, the way he treated women or something like that.
Yeah.
And you can look at that in a way as an interesting sort of extension of the fact that there he has had this sort of Bill Murray leeway for 40 years now, based on what people know, that's Bill Murray with in quotation marks. So he's famous for crashing people's weddings. He does this, he does that. And it's an interesting turn now that people are starting to say, you know, maybe some of those things you did as Bill Murray that weren't right. And it's not my judgment, it's their judgment. It's every individual's judgment.
Yes.
So I certainly accept, you know, the women who are saying that if he did this, but, you know, in a sense, it may have been hard for him to differentiate because he has this comedian's leeway that people weren't like that he would do crazy things because he was Bill Murray. So this is an interesting turn, I think, in terms of the stuff we were talking about before of you know, what works now and that what doesn't work now that might have worked then. I don't know. You know, it's an interesting experience. I don't know how it's going to shake out ultimately for him as a performer, as, you know, going forward.
I'll tell you how I want it to shake out. And mm-hmm. I think I do have a little bit of insight to this. Like I said, because of the men's mental health podcast that I host, and we have talked a lot about this. Because there's a lot of people, not just men, but men in general is the focal point of the other show. So, you know, I'm skewed a little bit, but there's a lot of people who, are afraid because of previous behaviors that were acceptable then, or even if they weren't acceptable then, it was, viewed again from a different lens back then versus now. And the one that I have I personally, as I see the pendulum have swung too far, this is again, just Mike's spitballing, but the idea that, and I'll bring up another example. There's Mr. Murray, you talk about him right now. I bring up Senator Al Franken. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think if a picture surfaces when he was a comedian, and I think we all know the picture that we're talking about with him on the military plane and the sleeping, soldier, you know, there should be an opportunity. If a picture like that surfaces, it's as simple as, oh, I'm sorry. You know what? Back then, I was a jackass, whatever the thing is, there should be the opportunity to make amends. And I think that's the pendulum has swung too far. If it just swings back a notch or two, something from school, I mean, I don't know. I never did blackface or anything like that growing up. But if something showed up of me in high school, I would love the opportunity to apologize
for it. I'm sorry, Don Gillis sent me a picture of you in blackface. So
if anybody would have it, it'd be him.
And he sent it. So just so you know, so when it comes out tomorrow in the press, you can't say you weren't warned. Okay,
That's right. But see, I never did it. But our prime minister in Canada, Justin Trudeau, famously has this picture that went out about him in high school or elementary school. I didn't do it. But I certainly was a part of, costume parties and things like that where people did it. All sorts of ways back then it was fine. And now I pity the people who have these, you know, skeletons in their closet, you know,
things change. I think part of Franken's problem was he was a little not great at the, if he simply just come out right and said, yeah, I was an idiot and this is what I did, but he didn't quite do that at the time. So that had something to do with it. I mean, I think frankly, I think he should probably go, this would be a good time for him to run for Senate again. I think you get back in. Frankly, and I think that's fine. The time has passed, and, you know, he's done his penance. Come on back and do that. You know, there are many people who probably suggest the best thing about him being in the Senate is he kept him out of comedy for a few years. But I'm not one of those people. I would never say that, of course.
Hey, did you know? Did you cross paths with Al along the? No, you didn't.
No,
right?
The closest I came to it with when he and when he was Franken and Davis, they were on the Letterman show.
Yeah, yeah.
And Carl and I had written a bit for that was on, supposed to be on that show that they were going to be in, and then. With Meryl's help, they genially rewrote it without, you know, to their liking, and you know, it's fine. It wasn't the greatest bit in the world anyway, but it was kind of a fun bit. And so they ad-libbed their way through it. But I don't think I even met him when they did that. So I have very little connection to SNL people in general, except the ones I work with.
He's a guy that I think that you would probably get along with because you're both extremely intelligent. You both have that that perfect askew way of looking at things and observing things and then communicating that. And I appreciate your intelligence and your insights so much, Steve.
Thank you.
You have this, and we didn't get to, you know, Steve Young, when he came on the show, he brought up the idea of the broken comedy writer and the comedy writer's mentality of the way that they look at life and you know they're sentenced to the idea when they find something hilarious to go, oh, that's funny, you know, and not belly laugh so much. I wanted to get into all of that kind of stuff with you. I mean, I've got a list as well that we didn't get to, but we're at the point where I think it's time to call it. I love you, man. I love you. I love Lori.
Likewise.
So grateful that you guys are
you
in
and Candy
life.
Both.
Oh man, this has been so much fun. Any last
here,
words
your
before
cup.
We get signed
off? This is your cup. So, you know, right here.
That means the world. Any final words?
I'm afraid
we,
to use it,
it
for anything because I'm afraid I'm going to break it. So I actually don't use it as a cup because I'm afraid it looks delicate to me. And I'm a klutz. So you know I'm. Oh, lady, wait. The whole cup with the maybe you could have it weaved. Sorry, it's the old Jerry line.
Just speaking of Jerry Lewis, by the way, for folks who the generation gap is really long, if you want to see a very cool Jerry Lewis thing that you might be able to access, watch The Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, Jerry Seinfeld with Jerry Lewis.
It wasn't funny, though. He was kind of sullen.
No, it's more nostalgic and him talking to him, seeing him with his Oscar sitting there, like
right,
it brings reverence to Jerry for sure.
Yeah, yeah, no, that you get, but you didn't
and
get
then going through some of the clips and talking about old show business and you might see why when you realize how much Jerry, you know, he was four departments, never mind, you know, four different roles, acting, directing, all that. He was four departments doing these movies that were making best picture or Oscar,
I lived to see a few years ago, they did Jerry Lewis at the Museum of Modern Art. They had a display of his storyboards and film clips. They had, you know, and I said, I'm so glad I lived long enough to see that, you know, it probably helped that he had already passed by that time. So he couldn't get in the way and cause trouble, but he was fully worthy of that. You know, whatever you think of him as human being, as an artist, I mean, he was a first-rate director. Ask Martin Scorsese, because you know he'd be the first to tell you. And he was very, and he invented the camera that so the video camera
like the steady cam
or video the... assist video assist
oh video assist. Oh yeah yeah
video assist he invented the video he invented that he you know the, in fact I always heard the story that he invented it. You know, that was the videotape that he had. The first thing he did was to actually, because they didn't have videotape, he actually had monitors put in all the upper corners of the set because there was no videotape. So the video
they would have had to
would
invent
and he would
how
be
we
glancing,
do that
be glancing
to make that happen.
He could glance at it during the shot.
Yeah.
So he could see how it was working. Then he flew to Japan to talk to the president of Sony to develop the technology. So when they say he invented that, they're not kidding. He had his hands in telling the president of Sony what he needed and what would work for him. And there is now, of course, everybody shoots on video, but in the, you know, for that, all those years of film, there is not a single director who did not use the video assist. And that's Jerry's. So.
See, you think of Steven Spielberg, you think of George Lucas when it comes to, you know, creating James Cameron for creating technology for, you know, to assist this kind of thing. You don't necessarily think Jerry Lewis. I'm glad that you mentioned that today. God damn, I love doing this. I can't wait for our next one. Can't wait to see you guys in person.
As you know, I'm chronically unemployed, so I'm very, very available. So
and again, this is the dreamer in me, but the idea that I've talked to so many folks who worked for any number of Dave's productions that would love to have an outlet to do something. And when I think of the idea of being able to create a platform or a place where people could do that, we talk about this idea of the Letterman Podcast Network and some of these other things that we're dreaming and pitching and all of these things. You're one of the first guys I think of that. You talk about chronically unemployed and all that. Oh my God, Stephen, you are a plethora of insight, wisdom,
thank you.
Entertainment.
I do want to plug one thing. I don't remember if I did last time. I think I did. Then we can wrap this up. Sure. Because when I say unemployed, I've been writing film essays for Criterion for a while now. And they can get them at the website. They also, Barnes & Noble still has their half price sale. The two I wrote the booklet essays for, Harold Lloyd's The Freshman, which is a masterpiece, and The In-Laws, Andrew Bergman and Arthur Hiller with Peter Falk and Alan Arkin. It's absolutely hysterically funny. And those two are available for half price, like all the other Criterion discs for the next. I don't get any money when they sell them, so this is just me doing it because I love those guys. The people at Criterion are wonderful, wonderful people. So I wanted to plug them for what they did and giving me this sort of second weird career.
I got rid of all of my DVDs except for the Criterion ones. I can't.
But do you have the Freshman and the In-Laws? Do you own a copy of those too?
I don't.
Well, you have about 4 days left to get the Blu-rays with these essays and fantastic extras, and they're both masterpieces, and they should be on your shelf. Both movies.
Okay. The next time, and I'm just going to throw this out to the ether as well. The next time we're in New York, I want to put you and I want to put Shecky in a room, and I just want to sit there and listen to you guys talk about old film. I'm a big fan of the passage of knowledge and the transfer of knowledge and all that. And you are that guy, and I just appreciate the hell out of you, man. Till the next time, and that's how we're going to say this. I hope the finger gets better.
It's almost. I can get it about halfway down now at this point, so we'll see.
Okay, I'll do a quick.
I'm
outro.
So glad it wasn't my right hand. Anyway, love to Candy. And we
absolutely,
will
I'll do a quick outro here, and then we can say our goodbye privately. So, I mean, this is a day off for me. Not that all the podcasts that we do here aren't a day off for me. They're all lovely, but obviously, just talking with friends is a phenomenal thing. Steve is just this amazing resource of memory, of insight, all of these things. I love this so much. Please, if you like this show, hell, if you don't like this show, please like, please share, please subscribe, all of that stuff. I'm getting sick and tired of saying it. I can't wait to get to the point where I don't have to say it anymore, but we're not there yet. Please like, share, subscribe the Letterman Podcast. Please join the Facebook group. And then, of course, the Letterman Podcast has one sponsor, and that is Rupert G and the Hello Deli. Go to hello-deli.com and check out the Letterman merchandise, the Rupert merchandise. And let's just, I'm just going to throw this out there, and please don't read into this as I say this. You won't be able to do that forever. It's been a great run, and hopefully that great run lasts longer for Rupert and May at the Hello Deli. But at the end of the day, shop there sooner than later. Go see him if you're in the New York area. Go see him sooner than later. Again, one of the most photographed people in the city of New York on a daily basis is Rupert G. My name is Mike Chisholm. This has been the Letterman Podcast with Mike Chisholm. I appreciate this so, so much. Let's build something. Let's continue and see what evolves from this. For the Letterman Podcast, thank you very much. My name is Mike Chisholm. Thank you and good night.
Overcoat and underpants.